The Minnesota Court of Appeals. We very much appreciate counsel appearing today. We are using remote technology via Zoom to conduct proceedings today. And we are on the second of our four cases that are set for this panel today. So I'll ask the marshal to call the second case.
Now calling case A210869. Duran 610 Apartments et al. Versus State of Minnesota by and through Governor Tim Walz et al.
All right, and I have just a couple of remarks before we go ahead. First of all, to remind both lawyers that you've had your connections checked. We believe everything's solid, but if you were to lose connection or not be unable to hear us, you know what to do in terms of contacting the court, and we will make sure allowances are made to get you back in touch to proceed with the argument. Please identify yourself as well as the client you represent. We are recording proceedings today, and that audio recording will be available later, and it helps keep you in touch. And then keep your eye on the clock. The time tends to go quickly. We really enjoy the opportunity to talk to you about the issues in the case. And so with that, we are ready for counsel for appellant. You can begin.
May it please the court, Jack Perry from the Taft Law Firm. And I again apologize for the technical issue. I made fun of Judge Wall last week because he had a half hour delay getting his screen up that day. I have a two-step analysis I'd like to walk the court through that I think will be helpful in your decision-making. And the first step in the analysis is to identify for you respondents' authority to enact the emergency orders, which I'll refer to as the orders. To begin with, on addendum number two in the first order, on page two of the first order that issued, the state admitted, quote, current laws do not allow for cessation of notices of termination, notices to terminate tenancies, eviction actions, or issuing writs of recovery during the COVID-19 pandemic, end of quotation. So in other words, the orders could not have been enacted by anything other than Chapter 9 and Chapter 12, which are the emergency authorities. As it relates to the executive council, the only authority they had to enact and to approve as they were required to and as they did, and to extend as they are required to and did the orders, was under 906.1 subdivision 1.1, which says that they can take such measures as are necessary. The reason we know that's what they had to use in order to approve and to extend these orders is there is no other authority under Chapter 9 for them to do so. There is no catch-all provision as to what their authorities are. This statute has been amended and subtracted, added to, but there is no catch-all as it relates to what they did here. The only possible authority they had is under 9.061 subdivision 1.1. Similarly, as it relates to what authority did the state use, the governor use, to enact the orders? The only possibility is 12.34 subdivision 1, parent 2, close parent. And how do we know that? Is there's been some talk in the arguments about, no, the governor was using 12.21 subdivision 3, which is the specific authorities. And in particular, there's a listing of 12 different specific authorities the governor can use or has during an emergency. And the suggestion, I believe, is that under subdivision 3.7, Roman numeral 6, that is the authority that the governor used. And that is suggested because in there it says the governor has authority for sheltering of persons. Sounds like what we have here. The problem is that the subdivision 3.7 begins with, this is authority the governor has to cooperate with, and then it has a listing of the president and other federal entities. There is no separate authority for the governor to simply enact provisions or order provisions to shelter persons on his own. So the only provision that the governor could have in this record taken the authority from to enact the orders is 12.34 subdivision 1.2, which refers to commandeering, which leads to the step two of the analysis, which is what does commandeering mean? And I'm going to begin with something that was not discussed in the briefs, and that was, what is this court supposed to do with the Buzzel decision? Following your Chauvin case from last March, the rule of law for the Court of Appeals is you're going to follow the published decisions as precedent. In fact, I think you've had seven cases since then, unpublished decisions, where you have reaffirmed what you said in Chauvin. However, in this case, unlike the Chauvin case and every other case, we have a scenario that less than 48 hours ago, the Solicitor General for the respondents, who's on the pleadings for this case, in the restaurant case, which was argued on Monday, abandoned the Court of Appeals ruling. And she did that as expressly and as explicitly as possible. And I transcribed what it was, and we can give this to you, but it's about halfway through Ms. Kramer's argument on Monday. Justice Thiessen asked, quote, "And you're not arguing really for the Court of Appeals definition?" The response, unambiguous, "No, only because I think the direct and active views did get into some difficulties that appellant properly raised in its briefing." If that wasn't enough, Solicitor General Kramer, twice in her argument on Monday, came up with alternative definitions for what commandeering means. So first, she told Justice Thiessen and the rest of the members of the court, we are not arguing for what this court did in Buzzel. Instead, we're going to ask you to come up with two different alternative meanings. One was to adopt the syllabus, which is not the court's opinion, but just the syllabus from Buzzel. The second is to adopt a new definition that requires commandeering to be defined as physical confiscation and seizure. The reason I begin there is that frees this court up is until Monday, I didn't know how I addressed this issue. But after Monday, there is no authority that I'm aware of that binds this court to a otherwise binding decision that has been jettisoned by the Solicitor General of the state. So now turning to how commandeering should be defined.
Well, Mr. Perry, am I understanding you correctly? You're suggesting that this court should change its view about its own presidential opinions based on the oral argument, strategy, approach, statements of the Solicitor General. I am struggling with that. So help me understand where that would be principled legal decision-making. You may well disagree with what we said in Chauvin about our view on the precedential effect of our own opinions on this court. That's fine, I understand that. But why would we change it in light of whatever the Solicitor General said in an oral argument with the Minnesota Supreme Court?
We have, in this scenario, Judge Bradfield, we have an issue of first impression. Everyone agrees. Under two statutes, what does commandeering mean under 9.061 subdivision 1, and what does commandeering mean under 12.34 subdivision 1.2 and subdivision 2? Never before addressed. This court said in the Buzzel decision, it means direct and active use, or active and direct use of the property by the government. And I think that and there's no authority, obviously, for this. There's no authority for what this court did in Chauvin, but the idea that this court should ignore what the litigants in the restaurant case and in this case, she is on the pleadings here, has told you we don't agree with how commandeering was defined in your prior case. And it would appear to me to be putting extraordinary emphasis on a technical ruling less than a year old in Chauvin, and in a situation where we are trying for the first time to figure out what a statute means. And on top of that, Judge Bradfield, is if it was simply one litigant saying, hey, I disagree with this, but the court in their hour-long questioning suggested, no, they thought it made sense. There was not one question by any of the justices that suggested anyone in that courtroom, any of the seven justices or either of the two litigants, were asking the court to adopt this court's decision in Bustle. I have no authority, Judge Bradfield. I don't. It just doesn't make common sense to me that we would stick a party, an appellant, with an interpretation which everyone has jettisoned. As to
Mr. the next Perry, can I just to follow up, what do we make then, since you're asking us to consider those arguments, where does the denial of the expedited discretionary review by the Supreme Court come into that? At least it would seem to me if, for instance, the Supreme Court itself was so obviously thinking contrary to Buzzle, they would have accepted that or maybe suspended it, stated, but they didn't. Does that play a part at all in your comments today?
Not at all, Your Honor. In fact, I would compare it to what the Supreme Court did in the Cruz-Guzman case in 2018. And there was a parallel case. That was a case about education adequacy, which I've been litigating for the last 6 years on behalf of charter schools. And there was a parallel case about what the meaning of education adequacy is in a case called Forsland, F-O-R-S-L-U-N-D, State v. Forsland. And both of them depended upon what does the education clause mean? And the Supreme Court denied review of Forsland, and we went forward with the Cruz-Guzman, and then the Cruz-Guzman case was used. That definition was then applied by the Court of Appeals in the Forsland, what we call the Forsland 2 case later on that year. So I think there's a parallel there. And the reason why, I mean, of course, I wanted them to accept review, but the issue in that case, in the restaurant case, in the Buzzle case, is what is the definition of commandeer? Same as here. So it's perfectly reasonable for the court to say, we don't need to have two different lawyers arguing about what the heck commandeering means. But again, I don't know what stock there could be. I've never seen a case where you're supposed to take a negative inference from the court declining review, accelerated review. As it relates to what interpretation you should have, is I think this is a very simple statutory construction. I don't think you ever get to the interpretation using definitions, because you don't get there. First, if you look at 9.0601, there are three reasons why under 90601 subdivision 2, commandeering has to be defined coextensive with the meaning of taking, the general taking under the Constitution and under chapter 117. And the reason is, first and foremost, is it begins commandeering and use the executive council may, when necessary, commandeer and use any property. Well, they're using commandeer and use synonymously, just as under the Constitution and under the 117. But they go on. The next sentence begins, the owner of any property taken. So they are using taken as a equivalent, because otherwise these sentences don't make any sense, with commandeer in use. And then it goes on in the second sentence to refer to use, paid for its use. And instead of talking about confiscation or seizure, it says in the service of the executive council, all of which indicates the same language you would anticipate under a takings analysis. Likewise, under 12.34, there are five reasons in the statutory context itself that compel your interpretation under the statutory reading that the commandeering is coextensive with the takings analysis under both statute and by the Constitution. The first is in the heading. It says all caps compensation for property taken, using the word taking exactly from the statute and the Constitution. The second is it distinguishes between in subdivision 1.1 and subdivision 1.2. The statute distinguishes between services which are non-compensable, consistent with the statute and the Constitution, vis-a-vis commandeering of property, which is compensable. The third thing that the statute does is it emphasizes that commandeering is not a confiscation or seizure because in subdivision 2 begins the owner commandeered property, meaning that the owner, in order to exercise its compensation, still owns the property. The property has not been seized and taken from him or her. It also uses in subdivision 2 the first sentence, just compensation, which is exact language from the statute and the Constitution. And it goes on to again use the word use three different times in the next two sentences, all tied similar to 909.061 to use. And my time is already up.
Any questions from the panel?
Of course, maybe in rebuttal.
Yeah, we've got 5 minutes for rebuttal for you, Mr. Perry. So those questions can be handled then. So with that, I think we're ready to hear from the state of Minnesota. And Council, you can proceed as respondent when you're ready.
Good morning. My name is Tom Madison, and I am the attorney for respondents. May it please the court. The district court here correctly held that the landlords failed to state a claim that a commandeering occurred under the Minnesota Emergency Management Act, or MEMA. The parties have repeatedly argued the unambiguous meaning, the plain meaning of the term commandeer, so I do feel it's helpful to review those dictionary definitions that have been referenced by the parties. Those dictionaries state that the term commandeer means to seize for military or government purposes, or to take forcible possession of property. In Bazell versus Walls, the published decision issued just over 6 months ago by this court, the court recognized that the plain and ordinary meaning of commandeer requires some form of direct and active use by the government. And with regard to Mr. Perry's comments regarding the pending appeal in this related Bazell matter. Clearly, oral argument was held in that case on Monday. And I think it's clear to everyone here that the Supreme Court may say something different when it adjudicates that appeal. It may clarify the reasoning that the Court of Appeals utilized in that case to reach its decision. That doesn't mean that Bazell was wrong. That doesn't mean that its analysis and his conclusions were wrong. And I did watch that hearing, as Mr. Perry did as well. I don't have a transcript in front of me. I think it's a stretch to submit to this court or for this court to conclude that the Solicitor General indicated that she did not agree with Bazell. In fact, I don't think that's accurate. And the respondents here submit that the court's reasoning in Bazell remains applicable. And in
did the Attorney General, though, propose a different definition for commandeering during those arguments?
Right. And during those arguments in Bazell, and I think it's helpful here as well, what the Attorney General's office asserted was that Bazell stands for the proposition that a regulation on the use of property during an emergency does not amount to a commandeer. So that's the rule that was advocated for to the Supreme Court. I advocate for that rule here in this case. It holds here as well. And that also incorporates the reasoning that this court utilized when it decided Bazell 6 months ago. So that is consistent.
Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Madison. I'm going to interrupt just briefly. Is anyone else having difficulty hearing Mr. Madison?
Okay. Yes.
I just wanted to check. I am understanding you, Mr. Madison, but it's like your connection is fuzzy, sort of like you're talking through some water or something. So I don't know where your mic is, but
Okay, here, I'll try.
That sounded good. So,
okay, I will try to speak closer to the microphone if that helps.
Yep, thank you.
Seems to.
Okay, thank you for letting me know.
Mr. Madison, can I ask you an appropriate pause, yep, perhaps? This is one of those cases that's always, to me, a little bit interesting, where everybody says the language is unambiguous and everybody's giving different. They did in the Buzzle case, they did in the Durand District Court, and then the Supreme Court heard yet apparently another definition. Maybe my broader question is this then. Well, that's a two-part question. How can something continue to be unambiguous? Generally, we do from a statutory basis analysis, we consider then if there's two reasonable interpretations, that then therefore that you do go beyond the language and then you start getting into legislative history. That's a part one of my question. Part two is I am interested in the constitutional aspect in the sense that since we have the broader, even under the definition in Buzzle and in accepted by your client, that it is a taking of a form, and meaning there, or at least it's not under the commandeering definition, but even under those definitions, there's some obtaining of property, and we have a constitutional provision that no property may be taken without due process. Isn't there some point in which a constitutional analysis needs to be incorporated in any form of a property, because I don't think there's a dispute that there's at least an indirect taking here. I think, in fact, your client perhaps agrees, but that's not commandeering, but that nevertheless would be a constitutional taking.
Sure. So first, regarding your first question and the dictionary definitions, let me know if you can't hear me well. So regarding the dictionary definitions, there are elements that the district court recognized that hold true and that allow for the court to utilize the plain meaning of the term commandeer. Some of those elements are that there's possession and control. This is discussed in the briefing of the parties. And the concept is that either the government directly possesses the property or it controls possession. This relates also to the idea of a seizure, where the government has cleared everybody out of the property, whether it's a vehicle or a building. And so then the government has exclusive control over the possession of that building and over its use. And the district court pointed to it's a direct action for the particular property and for an emergency purpose. So these are the dictionary definitions referenced by the parties, and they can be utilized by this court to affirm that no commandeering occurred here. And then for the second part of your question regarding the constitutional implications or analysis that Mr. Perry has been asserting. So it's important to note, one, there is not a constitutional claim before the court. This is a narrow issue. Is there a commandeering or not? And in my view, reviewing the takings jurisprudence, I think it's helpful to step back and remember that there can either be a physical taking or a regulatory taking of property. That's what comes under that entire line of constitutional jurisprudence. Then within a regulatory taking, it can either be categorical or non-categorical takings. And in my view, Mr. Perry is attempting to graft some sort of non-categorical regulatory taking analysis onto the term commandeer, and it just doesn't work. It doesn't work under the term's plain meaning. It doesn't work within the statutory scheme, and it fails.
Then going back, thank you, Mr. Madison. I appreciate that. On your first point, then, on the definition, and one of those definitions, and I saw that as well, as controls possession. It strikes me that that doesn't necessarily mean in all ways. And one of your points being is they're still free to own the property. They can evict for other reasons, apparently. I mean, so there's other controls, but I assume your client doesn't deny that there's a pretty important aspect that is control. That's a very interference with a contract that they have with a tenant who must pay. And it seems like little satisfaction to say, well, okay, it's just partial control. So therefore, and so that's the maybe part of my hang up, although I realize we got the Buzzle issue that we've talked about, but wouldn't that at least suggest by that definition, indirect control is control?
Right. I take it the court is referring to, well, is referring to control or that aspect of the property.
Right. It's a limit. In other words, limiting the possession, at least in one contractual way that they had with their tenant, and it is to be able to evict them. That is a element of a possessory control that the government through commandeering has limited to the landlord.
Yeah. And so to be clear on the contract piece, the executive orders state that the obligations of the tenant for rent, they continue. So it is, I would define it even a bit narrowly, the restriction here. It is on specifically whether the person can be removed from the property or evicted, but the obligations for rent continue. And all the, and what respondents are arguing here is that this statutory remedy, this legal remedy, is not available. There are, of course, other remedies that are available, political remedies, and landlords in the state have successfully achieved those remedies. That's referenced in our brief in the footnote at page 7, footnote 9. We've referenced the various forms of relief that have been provided. And at the time of the briefing, that was $150 million in rental assistance flowing to landlords. I believe at this time, if the court clicks on that link, it's up to $300 million. So we recognize that this is a regulation on the use of property that is significant, but there, just because the 12.34 commandeering remedies is not available doesn't mean that there has not been other remedies provided.
But maybe then can you explain why that definition, where I'm wrong, then the definition you just cited, for example, and in the brief, controlling possession, why that would not fit this scenario under the commandeering?
Sure. So under the term commandeer, the meaning is exclusive possession, or at least exclusive control over possession. It would be different if respondents here had gone to one of the apartment buildings owned by the landlords and said, we are turning your apartment building into a hospital. We are turning it into a morgue to deal with this emergency. That means everybody that's in the building, all of your tenants right now, they're all out and we need it tomorrow. So clear everybody out. They're all gone and we are taking this over and we're going to use it for as a hospital. And of course, it doesn't mean that the government has to directly be there the entire time. The government may bring in nurses from elsewhere to service and staff the hospital, but it's that type of exclusive possession and specifically control over possession that is a part of commandeering and that is not present here. Here it is a regulation on the use of property.
So all the dictionary definitions you're using uses the word exclusive?
So there's a number of dictionaries referenced. I don't recall if any of them use the word exclusive or if some do, some don't. I don't recall that, but I suggest that. And when this court looks at the same issue was confronted in New Jersey in the JWC Fitness case, which is cited in respondents' briefing. And they essentially used this similar reasoning and came to a similar conclusion using dictionary definitions. So I can't recall the extent to which exclusive is utilized by the various dictionaries.
So using the example you gave, if for the same order required landlords with all their vacant to allow homeless individuals to go into the vacant apartments under the pandemic because we don't want them out spreading, that would also not be commandeering then under your and under the Buzzle phrase of direct only definition and your client's argument that it must be exclusive?
No, I submit that if the government went to one of these apartment buildings and said, okay, landlord, we need this for a homeless shelter. That's for the emergency response for what we're doing. We need this building as a homeless shelter and they clear everybody out. then it is for the government is controlling possession of the building. It has seized the building. And the landlords no longer can access it. It's not being used in any way for the landlord's beneficial purpose. And then that would be a commandeering. In this case, the landlords have the apartment buildings at issue have been put to the beneficial purpose of being rented out, and that continued. The landlords continued to receive rental payments. The eviction restrictions here would only be if somebody fell behind on rent, but there's nothing in the record there's never been any facts put in by the landlords as to how many of their tenants actually fell behind on rent or how much back rent was owed. So it is the large chunk of the beneficial use continued for the landlords.
Council, on what you talked about as far as the $300 million fund created by the legislature to, in a sense, hold harmless the landlords in these cases, are you saying that that fund will ensure that if any tenant hasn't paid rent as a result of this action, that the landlords will be made whole, both for the money that they didn't receive at the time and for the cost of the use of that money over time?
Right. Thank you, Judge Kirk. Those relief funds have worked is that it requires a person who is behind on rent submits an application to Minnesota Housing, and there's other jurisdictions that have relief available also. And then if they qualify, payments are made directly to the landlords. I don't know the specifics on whether that would compensate for every particular harm. I know that I submit that it compensates for at some. I can't say whether it compensates in every conceivable manner.
But it seems to me then, just because of the advantage maybe of the statute to some people, that people that might not qualify for that rental assistance will have not paid their rent, and the landlord will be out as far as those folks are concerned.
Yes, and those relief programs have allowed for, my understanding is that they've allowed for landlords to even assist their tenants. So if a landlord has a tenant who's behind on rent, that they can fill out the application, tee it all up for that tenant. And so then basically all they have to do is sign, and then those relief funds would flow to the landlord. So it's been done in a way to address this very situation as best as possible. And I know I'm over time, but I have one other point I'd like to make on that, if that's permissible.
Let me just check with the panel first. Any questions? All right. And Mr. Madison, if you could just limit your one additional comment, please. Thank you. Go ahead.
Sure. So this is one other thing for the court to consider. The executive orders were concluded in June of 2021. That's when the emergency declaration ended. And that's when there was an off-ramp legislation for these eviction restrictions. Those are referenced in the landlord's briefing. They talk about repeatedly about a 19-month period. I think it's important to note that period encompasses, that would go from March of 2020 until October of 2021. So that's incorporating time when the legislature adopted eviction restrictions as well. And the legislature said, as long as you've got an application for rental assistance pending, then you still aren't subject to an eviction. So I think that also makes it very difficult to adopt the landlord's position when considering that the legislature continued many of these restrictions while the rental assistance applications were pending.
Great, thank you very much. So with that, I think we're ready to reset the clock for rebuttal. All right, we've done that. So counsel for appellant, we're ready to hear from you.
I know, Judge Kirk, you had a question, but I guess I wanted to finish the analysis. I gave you the provisions within 9.061 subdivision 1 and the provisions within 12.34 that I believe compel this court to construe commandeer consistent with use, because they're used interchangeably, and with the term taking, all used interchangeably, repeatedly, using the same language that you find in the statutes. and the Constitution. But there are three rules of construction, because Judge Slater, you mentioned that we all think it's plain. I don't think it's plain. That's why we have rules of construction here that I think will help you. And the first rule of construction is one I thought, Judge Slater, you were somewhat alluding to, is that it's 645.173. Again, 645.173. And that's the rule of construction that requires you to construe statutes so as to be constitutional. The interpretation that is being fostered here is that what is in normal conversations would be clearly a regulatory taking for whether it's 16 months or 19 months. And that would be in violation of Article 1, Section 13 of the Constitution and Chapter 117. It can't be interpreted that way, because clearly we are using our rights as interpreted in the Olson case by Justice Thiessen's, was the author of the Olson case in 2019, clearly taking away one's right to evict, to charge rents and collect rents. That is a property interest. And in every other context undertakings, that's recognized. The second rule of construction is 645.172, which means you cannot eliminate words. You read it as a whole. The reading that the state is presenting to you is you eliminate when it says commandeering and use, and then uses use multiple times in both statutes, just eliminate use. Doesn't have any meaning. You can't do that. The third rule of construction is 645.16. Which is the intent of the statute, which is supposed to be preeminent, is you look at what did the legislature intend. And in this case, in 1951 and 1953, respectively, when these two statutes, the provision at issue, the commandeering, was enacted, the only thing people knew about was takings. And the only significant change, or two changes that were created by these statutes, is it codified the ability of the governor to exercise this power under the civil defense and then subsequently amended, and for the executive council 2 years later to have to approve of that. It was all in the context of we're going to extend these powers to the executive branch to do whatever is necessary in these emergency situations. We are not objecting to what was done. We are just simply following the statute, and the statute says when you exercise that executive branch, you need to pay for it. Similar to any condemnation proceeding, you have to pay for it. The last point I want to make, and then I'm rudely not giving you time, Judge Kirk, to ask your question, but I think the most important part of this is that the state volunteered in the Buzzell case in the district court, and the district court memorialized it in footnote 4 of its decision, that they gave a hypothetical, actually a couple hypotheticals. But the one that was adopted was they require, this is their one example of commandeering, requiring all Minnesota restaurants to become mess halls. And the court, in its order, the district court, the parties all agreed that if the government had forced Buzzell into operating a mess hall out of his business, that would be commandeering his property under 12.34. Well, in that case, Buzzell is still retaining the ownership. The property is not being seized in the confiscation. He still owns it. He is just being forced to operate it. And I think that the court had a little bit wrong, though, because there's two things. Is Buzzell would not be compensated under 12.34 subdivision 1.1. Buzzell would not be compensated in that scenario for his services, because that's not covered by the Constitution and by 117. Instead, he would be, consistent with what they said here, he would be compensated because it would be a commandeering of his property, not his services. He'd have to provide those for free under one subdivision, 12.34 subdivision 1.1, but not under 2. I ran out of my time. I don't know if Judge Kirk, you still have that question or if I answered it.
No, I think it's been answered one way or the other, so that's fine.
Anything else from the panel? All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Perry. Was there one last thing you wanted to say, or?
There was, but I didn't think I was.
You know, and of course, the briefing was excellent here. So yeah, go ahead quickly.
Well, I guess the only thing I would say is there are two cases, the Jersey and Illinois case, that were cited subsequent to briefing, and in both cases, the hypothetical that was posed by the state eviscerates the relevance of those decisions. Because in both those cases, it requires the actual confiscation and the seizure of the property, which is what the state has already conceded is, you know, that's not what commandeering requires under their hypothetical. It just requires you to force someone to use their property, like in the Louisiana cases, force them to use that property for some amount of time. Thank you.
Thanks so much. Thanks to both lawyers. This matter has been very well briefed and well argued. We so appreciate hearing from you. And it's now submitted to this court for its decision. We will issue a decision within the statutory timeframe. So with that, we've completed arguments on the second matter, and we'll get ready for the third case on our calendar.